Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. In the year 2000, measles was declared eliminated from the U.S. However, the number of measles cases has increased since then, and there have been outbreaks this year in at least three states, probably even more, including New York, Texas, and Washington. Even though more than 90% of Americans have been vaccinated against measles, there are more people deciding against vaccinations. Outside the U.S., it's a different story. Measles killed 110,000 people in 2017, mostly children under the age of five. We're going to talk about measles and vaccinations today with our guest, Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, welcome to the program.
Okay, thank you for having me back.
And of course, we should mention that UPMC Pinnacle is one of Smart Talk's sponsors. Dr. Renee Nahara, who is an editor of the History of Vaccines, a site run by the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. He's also an epidemiologist. Dr. Nahara, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to say that when I talked with several people about the program that we're doing today, got to kind of the same results, was that, or I should say the same reaction, is that, I thought measles wasn't a thing anymore in the United States. And really, if you look at the numbers, it is only in the hundreds compared to, as I said, in the other countries where it can be in the tens of thousands. But we'll talk about why we are seeing an increase, but how about we start with some definitions. Dr. Goldman, what is measles?
So measles is a virus that used to, before vaccinations, infect essentially everyone before the age of 15. It typically makes people fairly sick. They get high fevers around 100, up to 103, 104. They get a cough. They get a rash, a red rash that starts off in their face, spreads to the rest of their body. Usually they also have a runny nose. And when you see, I've only seen two real cases of measles.
See, I was going to ask that question if you have. Yeah.
I've only seen two cases. And the people, when they have it, they're sick, high fevers, they feel crummy, they've got conjunctivitis, red eyes, a cough, a sore throat. But most of them recover. On the other hand, roughly 1 out of 10 get an ear infection. Roughly 1 out of 20 gets a pneumonia. The 1 out of 1,000 gets encephalitis. The virus attacks the brain. And between 1 and 2 out of 1,000 die as a direct result of the measles, either because of the pneumonia or because of the encephalitis, because of the attack on the brain. Now, in the United States, before vaccination, there were roughly 500,000 reported cases and 3 to 4 million cases of the measles. And so if you think about it, even though most people recover, even though most people, nothing bad happens, if you have 3 or 4 million people getting a disease and 1 out of 1,000 dies, there would typically be about 500 deaths each year from the virus. The issue is that this virus is eliminated from the United States. We do not have naturally occurring cases. They aren't originating in the United States and spreading from person to person. On the other hand, this is one of the most contagious viruses on Earth. If you are exposed to measles and you're not immune, you're not vaccinated, 90% of the people get measles. You can get measles by walking by a room, in the hallway, walking by a room where someone has measles. And if you're in a room where someone that had someone with measles in it, the air in that room remains infectious for roughly 2 hours. So if there's someone who has measles, and they can spread it to many people. Now, and the problem is that most of the measles outbreaks in the United States have come from measles that were imported. So either someone, in the case of the New York outbreak, traveled to Israel where they're having an outbreak, brought the measles, was unvaccinated, brought the measles back home. In the case of the California outbreak a couple of years ago.
Disneyland, yeah.
Yeah, someone from another country brought their kid to Disneyland. The kid had measles. But if you can imagine the number of people you can expose at Disneyland and in the airports traveling to and from California, you can expose thousands of people. And in order for measles not to be transmitted, roughly 95% of the population has to be immune. The virus is so infectious that it will find those small number of people who are not immune. So measles is a very contagious virus. Before vaccination, basically everyone got it. And most people survive it. A small number of people get encephalitis, because it attacks the brain. That can cause learning disabilities, mental retardation, and a small number of people die. The problem is if you're infecting 3 to 4 million people a year, the small number of people who die times the small percentage who die times 3 or 4 million still ends up being 500 people a year. Now, those deaths are completely avoidable. Those infections are completely avoidable. Because if you are vaccinated, the vaccine works 97% of the time.
If you get two shots.
If you get two shots.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you get one, it's 93%. If you get two, it's 97%.
And typically, you get those shots at what ages?
The first one is recommended in the U.S. to be given at 1 year of age. Mm-hmm. The second one is right before elementary school, 4 to 6 years of age. Because the vaccine is, you're expected to have some immunity from your mother when you're born, and that immunity will wane around the first year of life. That's when you get the first shot. The second one is because the evidence showed that there was this small cohort of people who didn't quite get immune because, again, you know, it's 93%, so not quite 100. When they got to elementary school, we wanted to absolutely make sure that they were immune, so we gave them the second one to bring that up all the way to 97.
And excuse me for jumping around on you, but since you brought that up, one thing I did see is people born before 1957, because the vaccine only became readily available like the early 60s.
In 63. Yeah.
So are there people who were born before 1957 who have never been vaccinated?
Never been vaccinated, yes.
Okay.
And they're probably in the minority. The two have been exposed and had it. Probably everybody did before the vaccine. Because it was so infectious, everybody would get it.
Dr. Goldman, something you said, and I used in my introduction here, that measles has been eliminated. To most people, that sounds like, okay, we will not see one case. It's been eliminated according to the Centers for Disease Control. But eliminated doesn't exactly mean eliminated, does it?
It doesn't. It's been eliminated from the United States. It hasn't been eliminated from the rest of the world. So there are lots of places in the world where measles is still a common childhood illness. And the problem is that we live in a world where people travel. And so people from those countries can end up coming to the U.S. and exposing us, or we can travel to those countries and be exposed. So the reason that even though it's quote-unquote eliminated, we don't see it occurring in the U.S. and transmitted in the U.S. from someone who got measles here. We always see measles as a result of either travel or exposure from someone who has traveled. So it's been eliminated in the United States. It has not been eliminated from the world.
As I said earlier, we're talking about hundreds of cases here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. as opposed to thousands or tens of thousands overseas. Why the big concern then if we're talking hundreds of cases out of 300 million people?
Well, partially because when you're having hundreds of cases, you're having disease you do not have to have. In addition, there are people who cannot get vaccinated for the measles vaccine. Children that are too young, people who have immune compromise and can't receive the measles vaccine as a live vaccine and can't receive that vaccine. And so when people are not vaccinated, if they spread it, they can not only spread it to, you're not only taking a risk for your children, you're taking a risk for other people's children or other people who may get very sick if they're exposed. We also have seen that when people stop getting vaccinated, more outbreaks occur. So because the virus is so infectious, there will be exposures. It's not eliminated from the world. We will have people who travel here and expose people here. We will have people who travel somewhere else and get exposed somewhere else. if everyone were vaccinated and the vaccination rates were high, that exposure would be the only, that would be the only case. What happens now is we have that exposure. They come back here, and it gets transmitted person to person among unvaccinated people.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about the vaccine and vaccinations in just a moment. Quick question. Is there a cure for measles?
Well, measles is, there is no treatment of measles. The cure is your body gets, eliminates it from your system naturally. So again, most people, they get the measles, they get an antibody response, they're not going to get it again, they clear it naturally. There are no treatments which will make that disease less severe. So if you have measles encephalitis, if you have measles attacking the brain, we give you supportive care. We don't give you antivirals. We don't give you anything that support that makes the disease shorter. We just try to get you through it until your body clears the virus.
Are there comparisons to other illnesses like that? I mean, because the vaccination, and we're going to, again, talk about the vaccinations in just a moment, the vaccine, is an MMR vaccination. It's not just for measles, also for mumps and rubella.
Yeah.
So that question, though, of, I forget what my question was, but
the this is actually the way most viruses work.
Okay.
There's relatively few viruses that we have good treatment for. So, for example, if you get the mumps, we just give you supportive care. If you get rubella, if you get German measles, we just give you supportive care. There are a couple of viruses where we have specific antivirals for, but that's a minority. Most viruses we prevent with vaccination.
Mm. We'll talk about the vaccinations vaccine in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things reasonable. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about measles, the vaccinations, vaccines. Our guest today, Dr. Renee Nahara, an editor of the History of Vaccines, a site run by the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. He's an epidemiologist. And Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Nahara, you edit the history of vaccines, and I've read some of the articles on the site, and it's especially timely today because I saw in a publication that you had written in the state of Washington where there has been an outbreak. And by the way, outbreak of measles, we're talking just a few, but still a disease that is eliminated, considered eliminated, a few is considered an outbreak.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about history. Now, I know we're going back to the 1790s, but with vaccines, man has been trying to find vaccines for illnesses and disease forever. But let's go back about to the vaccine, the MMR vaccine.
So the MMR vaccine is a success story when it comes to a vaccine that goes to the public and eliminates the disease. It was researched over many years in the 1950s and 60s, and even before that there were some attempts. Once the virus was identified, there were some attempts to develop it. And it wasn't until 1963 that the breakthrough came through of, hey, we have this vaccine that is we did the clinical trials and it works great. And the way that they tested it was to give it to many children and actually try to see how many of them got measles, and remember at that time everybody got measles.
Right.
Well, those who received the vaccine didn't. And the other thing they did very interestingly was that they collected samples from their throats to see if the measles virus that they were given as a vaccine would come out. And so, because the worry was that they would be infectious to other people because it was a live virus vaccine, it wasn't. They wouldn't shed it. If there was any shedding, it was because they had some kind of secondary thing going on that they would shed the virus. But generally, you get the measles vaccine, you become immune, you don't shed it, you actually start protecting others by being the barrier between somebody who's infected and somebody who's not. And so You see the cases of measles drop precipitously once the vaccine gets licensed. I mean, they drop to almost nothing, you know, a couple of dozen a year after the vaccine is licensed in the U.S. The number of deaths from measles was already on the decline, but that was because medical technology was advancing. We were able to keep people alive when they developed encephalitis or pneumonia. So the number of deaths steadily declined, but we still had millions of cases of measles until the vaccine. In the 1990s, the late 1990s, a fraudulent study comes out of England that tries to link the MMR vaccine to autism. And the study itself, it's been recalled. It's been said, you know, it's not valid. It was a fraud. But even within the study itself, the scientists concluded that there was no link between the vaccine and autism. But the principal investigator in the study said that it was his gut feeling. Just his feeling that
one guy
had a press conference and said, it's my feeling that there is a link between the vaccine and autism. And we were off to the races with the conspiracy theory that the MMR vaccine caused autism. We spent a lot of time and a lot of money trying to confirm this gut feeling or find something, you know, some evidence against it. All the evidence points that the MMR vaccine is safe, it's effective, it doesn't cause autism, it has no association whatsoever with autism. There are other things that lead somebody to be autistic, but that is genetics and that is more the structure of their brains and et cetera, not the vaccine. But after that, a lot of people beginning in the UK and then spreading to the US because this person decided to travel to the US and spread his gospel here in the US, they became mistrustful of the MMR vaccine. And we have pockets in Washington State and in New York City and in Texas where an elementary school or a kindergarten has up to 60% of their children not vaccinated against the MMR.
And so you anticipated my next question, but it is growing. I mean, even though we hear often that one study has been debunked, we have a lot of people that will say that, okay, I've decided not to get my children vaccinated or myself vaccinated for religious reasons. Maybe the possibility that it causes autism, or there are people who see it as a liberty issue that the government shouldn't be telling me what I have to do. Is it true, is it accurate that the number of people who are opting out is growing across the country?
Yes, it's growing. It's certainly much more than it used to be, and there are forces at work through social media, through pop culture that are fomenting this kind of behavior, these kinds of beliefs. I classify them in two different camps. Number one is the parent who has legitimate concerns because we as parents, we care about our children. When I took my daughter to get vaccinated, they had several syringes out with needles and I was stunned. But I knew
as a doctor, you were stunned.
Yeah, I was stunned. But really? I relied on my scientific knowledge to know that she was going to be okay. And if anything, I was doing this for her own good. Mm-hmm. But a parent who doesn't have the scientific background, doesn't have time to actually do honest, good scientific literature reviews, they may not have that knowledge. And so they see all these syringes. Then they hear from a friend or a colleague or somebody that, hey, the vaccine might cause X or Y disease. And now they're hesitant. And so that hesitancy begins to fester until it becomes a vaccine denialism, a confirmation of their bias through social media postings, through people in pop culture saying things that are not accurate about vaccines, and it gets bad. The other camp is the people who profit from these things, and we can have a whole lot of discussion about them.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that's unusual about this, though, is that you say that a lot of people who have decided against vaccinations don't have the scientific knowledge. But one of the things that studies have shown, I understand, is that these are people who have, for the most part, better educations than the general public. So we're not talking about people who are uneducated or, you know, just don't have access to this kind of information. These are people who have been fairly well educated, but yet think that there is something wrong.
Yeah, but that's kind of a generalization of who is vaccine
hesitant. I know.
But education doesn't necessarily mean that you understand biology, virology, microbiology, chemistry, toxicology, the things that are the basic science of how vaccines work. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that we do with the History of Vaccine site, is that we lay out the foundations of how the vaccines came to be, how they've been improved over time, and all the scientific stuff that somebody would need to make an informed decision. Because that is, when somebody speaks of, it's my decision, they're making a misinformed decision, then that is not really a free decision. That is not really something that, you know, they are doing willingly. They're actually being forced into making a bad decision by being misinformed.
Dr. Goldman, and I hope I'm not telling tales out of school here, but times that you've been on the show before, I know that you have gotten upset. I think we were talking specifically about the flu shot, about when people would not get a vaccination ahead of time because, as you say, these are illnesses that can be prevented. So, have you gotten upset? Are you upset with the...
this is actually worse than the flu, because you're exposing people who don't have a choice to a disease that is at times fatal. So there have been cases where the parent chooses to not vaccinate their child. They go to the pediatrician. The pediatrician in the waiting room has a six-month-old kid. 6 months is before you get the measles vaccine. And as a result, the unvaccinated kid transmits it to the kid who never made the choice. Or the highest risk people are people who are immune compromised. They have an immune deficiency, they're on chemotherapy, and they can't get the vaccine. So not only are you making a choice to expose your child to risk, but you're potentially making a choice to expose other people's children to risk. If you look at U.S. life expectancy, U.S. life expectancy took off, went way up when we eliminated childhood illnesses because kids didn't die. Vaccines are one of the greatest public health successes in our history. They prevent kids from getting sick, they prevent complications, they prevent kids from dying, and as a result, the actual life expectancy in the U.S. went up. The best way I've heard it put is, what a vaccine, you know, all the complications, to vaccine produce autism, to vaccine produce complications, vaccines produce adults because kids don't die.
Let's take some phone calls here. Julie is in Mechanicsburg. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm actually calling because I know you touched on it earlier about mumps, measles, and rubella being all in one vaccination. I know as a mother, I mean, I actually vaccinated my children because I believe in it. But I will tell you that, like, fundamentally, it's a problem when you go into the doctor's office and they're giving you multiple vaccinations at once. So you might have mumps, measles, and rubella in one arm and then something else in the other arm. And I think as parents are concerned that having multiple things at once maybe is a little hard on an immune system, especially a young child. So I was just wondering why they don't just have simply a measles vaccination. I wonder if you could answer that question.
Thank you very much for your call.
Yeah, so there used to be a time when it was just measles. But then it got combined with the other ones because they were diseases that would trend around the same time, you know, childhood diseases. They also were, the mumps and rubella, they're also live virus vaccines. And so here we had measles, mumps, and rubella, all three hitting people at the same time, all three being needing to be alive. And so the combination was made. With regards to the worry about the young, quote-unquote, young immune system, a child's immune system is pretty hardy at that age. And the the amount, we call this the antigens that go into a vaccine, the amount of virus that goes into the vaccines is at an all-time low, because through research, we have fine-tuned the formulation of the vaccines so that we are giving in a vaccine the bare minimum of what the virus needs to be to trigger the immune response from the child. Not to overwhelm it, not to harm the immune system, but to give it that coaxing and that bit of information that it'll need to react to the actual virus should it ever encounter it. So yeah, like I said before, I went to get my daughter vaccinated and saw these
yeah, combinations. That's what I was thinking of when she was describing
yeah,
that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is an honest, true fear, because we're parents and we care about our child. But once you realize, number one, This is a vaccine that's been around since 1963. Billions of people have gotten it. It protects against a very harmful and somewhat deadly disease, and that it's been refined so that the child is getting the bare minimum of the dosage that they need. It kind of clicks into place that it's safe. And then you see the numbers. You see the numbers of cases dropping precipitously, and you see the number of deaths dropping to zero in the U.S. It's effective. And that's the kind of information that would feed into somebody and make them understand that it's a good thing.
Okay, since we've had the elimination of measles, and again, we use that word because, mathematically, it has been eliminated. Is it the same with rubella and mumps then?
Not so much with mumps. It's still circulating, particularly in younger populations, college age. High school, college age, they still get it, and it's probably a function of waning immunity, because when it's not around in the community, we don't get boosted. So if it's not around, we don't get boosted, and then you concentrate a whole bunch of people whose immunity has waned, and somebody brings it in, and you get these things. Rubella, thankfully, yes. Rubella, kind of the same thing. It's the cases of rubella are a handful, if that, in the United States. The worst thing from rubella is that if a pregnant woman gets it while pregnant, the child is born, and I have seen a child born with congenital rubella syndrome. It's horrible. It's heartbreaking.
What is rubella, by the way?
It's a very similar to measles. It's a virus that is also respiratory, but also causes the rash and the fever and the encephalitis. And in the unborn fetus, it causes severe deformities. And we're talking severe, life-threatening, life-ending deformities of the child. So a woman who's pregnant, usually as part of prenatal care, gets titers done to see if they're still immune to rubella, the German measles, mm-hmm. and if they're not, they're given a booster shot to make sure that, they're not given it while they're pregnant, but if they're planning on being pregnant, they're given the booster shot to make sure that they're immune.
You ever seen, Dr. Goldman, rubella cases, mumps?
I've not seen a mumps case, although mumps is more common.
I had mumps as a kid.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Got it from my sister.
Most of them, as you said, are now college outbreaks, so they're probably seen more frequently by people in student health services. I've seen a couple of cases of rubella. Again, it was a long time ago, and it was again with some waning immunity, but only one or two.
I'm curious, when we watch medical dramas on TV, there always is a hero doctor. Maybe you guys are the heroes at your hospitals. But anyway, they're finding a rare illness or a rare disease, and it's recognized. My question is, do you recognize when you see, Dr. Goldman, you said you've seen two cases of measles. Do you recognize that because you've seen so few and they are so rare?
So first of all, I think I would recognize measles.
Well, yeah, I mean, after you, the rash and everything.
Yeah, so I think I would see it. The problem would be that they are very easily missed, because if you think about it, most people aren't going to present to an infectious disease specialist. Most people are going to present to their primary care physician. Most primary care physicians are used to seeing standard illnesses. I'm used to seeing standard illnesses. And so to pick out, there's an expression, when you hear hoofbeats, don't think of zebras. To pick out the zebra is very difficult. And so to pick out the rare disease is hard. And so it's a much higher chance that a rare disease, any rare disease, is going to be missed. So we hope that the first time that you see a case of measles, you will recognize it. In addition, there are atypical presentations in people who have partial immunity. And quite honestly, I'm not totally sure I would recognize an atypical presentation right away. So when you have a very rare disease, any very rare disease, the chances that it initially will be missed go way up. Again, I've seen two cases of measles, two cases of rubella. That's not the first thing I'm thinking of.
Well, and some of the symptoms that you described, I mean, very early on, flu-like symptoms. People mm-hmm. think of a cold, a lot of the same kind of symptoms. And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it like 4 days before a rash develops?
It can be up to 4 days that the rash develops, that people frequently will present with partial symptoms. So again, easy to miss.
Mm. Let's take another phone call from Heather in Harrisburg. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi. We recently had an issue in our family. My mother-in-law went to a clinic to just get a checkup on some things, one of the, you know, new 24-hour clinics you have around here. And while she was there, she got checked out. She left. A couple days later, she gets a call from the health department, and there was a lady in there who had measles. So she was actually, my mother-in-law was quarantined for 21 days. Removed from her job, had to go and basically sit in her house for 21 days without going to work, no paycheck coming in, you know, nobody was allowed to come in and visit her, nobody was allowed to anything. And it was a huge inconvenience. She was just blessed enough not to have measles, but and she had been vaccinated as a kid, but it was just a, you know, one of those things where just better safe than sorry. I think that it's really inconvenient for people that they want to do this and they don't want to have the vaccinations, but then it's okay for everybody else to suffer the consequences. You know, I think it's really a bad thing. I don't think that your kids should be allowed to go to school if they're not vaccinated. I don't think that, you know, fine, homeschool your kids. Don't put the rest of us at risk. Don't put elderly people at risk. You know, stay in your cave.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And we have a couple of emails along the same lines. So, Dr. Harry, you wanted to say something about that?
No. Well, I wanted to make an emphasis that of her last point that, yeah, when it comes to vaccination, yeah, we benefit personally from getting being immune and not getting the disease later on. But we're also benefiting the entire community where we live. And so we talk about the concept in epidemiology of community immunity. And with something so infectious like measles, we need about 93 to 94% of the community to be immunized. And when I say community, I mean not just your neighborhood, but also the places you frequent, your church, your school, places like that. And so if we fall below that threshold, outbreaks begin and people get it. And so like she said, you know, we may make the decision of not to vaccinate, but it's going to affect our entire community.
This just, CNN just put this on Twitter. The head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration says that if states don't require more school children to get vaccinated, the federal government might have to step in.
So the authority under the Constitution to enforce vaccine mandates falls to the states as their police powers, and this has been backed up by three very well-documented Supreme Court cases. The federal government doesn't have the authority to say either vaccinate or you don't get X or Y benefit. But what they do have is the power of the purse. So like with speed limits, for example, they can say, all right, well, if you don't have everybody up to date on their vaccinations, dear state, we're going to withhold some sort of financial thing from that. I don't know personally if I would have gone that way. But it gets the conversation going of, hey, you know, maybe enough is enough when it comes to philosophical exemptions to vaccination. Just because you say, I don't believe in vaccines, I shouldn't get vaccinated, and still be able to send my child to public school that is paid for by tax dollars. Maybe it's time to rethink that strategy. And a lot of places like Washington State, they're starting to discuss bills where they eliminate the personal belief exemptions.
When you say philosophical, are you also including religious exemptions in on that? Because I know that here in Pennsylvania, Lancaster County, for example, is one of the counties that has some of the most religious exemptions out there. Many people think of it as the Amish that are exempted. But when you say philosophical, you also are including religious exemptions.
It's a very touchy subject, right?
I always
and I don't
is.
Want to dance around it.
I don't.
But from my own studies, and I'm not a theologian, from my own studies, there are very few religions in the world, and none of the major ones, who say thou shalt not vaccinate. They say live for your religion, live for your ward, don't die because of it. And so when we fail to vaccinate, we are putting people at risk of dying for the belief. And so then those people don't go on to live for the belief. So me as an epidemiologist, public health professional, yes, I do include religious exemptions to the philosophical exemptions. There will be situations, because it's a political issue by its very nature, where religious exemptions will be allowed for truly held religious beliefs. The other exemptions of, I just don't believe in it, I believe X and Y celebrity, will not be allowed.
Jenny McCarthy should not be your... it is Jenny McCarthy, right? Who is like one of the leading spokespeople.
One of the pop culture people.
Yeah, you shouldn't be getting your medical advice from Jenny McCarthy.
You shouldn't be getting your medical advice from anybody who is not a licensed healthcare provider.
Mm. Although, you know, I said that kind of sarcastically, but at the same time, she's a true believer. She believes that her son, I don't know the whole story, but that she has a son who has autism, and that she feels that the, so, you know, I don't want to, that's the fine line you also have to walk too, is you can't disparage people at the same time.
No. You never want to do that, especially with parents, because we're hitting a nerve when it comes to our children. If anybody looks funny at my child, I have this sensation of wanting to protect them. And so here you have a parent, and be it Ms. McCarthy or whoever, who the child, there is something quote-unquote wrong. I personally don't believe there's anything wrong with being autistic. There's something not normal, and so they want to attribute it to something, anything. They want somebody to pay for it, and that's a very natural feeling for a parent that sees their child being hurt or wronged in some way. But then we take that to the scientific and to the studies at a population level, and we see that no, vaccines have nothing to do with autism. If anything, people with autism, with severe forms of autism that keep them, you know, in institutional settings, etc., they're benefited by being immunized because they avoid the kind of things that spread like wildfire through an institution or through a school for children with special needs.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. By the way, coming up on future Smart Talks, you know, we have the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island. That's coming up March 28th is actually the 40th anniversary. But starting next week, March 1st, here on Smart Talk and throughout WITF, we'll be telling stories of the 40th anniversary of the TMI accident. Coming up tomorrow, part of our program, we always have a little fun with this. The Central Pennsylvania Spelling Bee is this weekend here at WITF, and we always have a couple of our staff members in who try to spell some of the words. Actually, they give us some of the easier words to spell, and we don't do so well with it. But that's always a good time, and just kind of let you know just how bright these spellers are, and just the kind of competition that they go through. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. But today we're talking about the measles. We're talking about the vaccine. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org, or you can go on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Our guest today, Dr. Rene Nehera, he's the editor of The History of Vaccines, a site run by the College of Physicians in Philadelphia, and an epidemiologist, and Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. 1-800-729-7532 is the phone number. We're getting a lot of emails here. Kelly has one. The listener Kelly has one that I actually have to admit that I thought about this. My issue with your conversation this morning is that complications of measles are grossly overstated in the media, as is being demonstrated today. Contagious, absolutely, but the fear tactics are maddening. In 1960, even before there was a vaccine, the total risk in the U.S. for contracting and dying from measles was 0.0002%. Your guests haven't mentioned mentioned that studies show that measles complications arise in nutrient-deficient individuals, vitamin A, and those without clean water and sanitation. Have they read those studies? Well, there's a couple questions there. Let's start with the media part of it. I mean, we've pointed out that we're talking about a few hundred cases out of 300-plus million people. Is there an overhype by the media talking about this?
With the problem is that we only see a few hundred cases now. If you really were to get people with 60% non-vaccination rates, you would see many more cases of the measles. And so one of the things is this is a disease that we eliminated. There are times where we only saw half a dozen cases in the United States. We're now not only seeing a couple hundred, but the numbers have been generally increasing from year to year. So I actually agree. Your chances of dying from the measles are probably less than your chances of dying on your car ride home from a car crash.
Much less, actually.
Much less, yeah. On the other hand, we don't want to see that go up. And we, besides just dying, there is the encephalitis, there's learning delays. There are a lot of complications of these disease. Also, there's a small number of people who die from the measles. But if you started having outbreaks of measles, mumps, rubella, all of the diseases which we used to see, which have been eliminated by vaccination, you'd see a whole lot more people sick and you'd see a whole lot more people dying.
Plus, we'll have to add that part of the premise of the show is that there are more people opting out of the vaccination, which...
It's not a good trend.
Yeah.
It's not a good trend. And it's a harbinger of things that could be. And so here we are early in the process, somewhat early in the process, trying to avoid hitting that threshold where community immunity fails and you have really big outbreaks like we're seeing right now in Europe, in Madagascar, in Venezuela, where because there's just not an availability of vaccine or there's vaccine refusal, you see these enormous numbers of cases, thousands of deaths, many injuries from developing measles and other vaccine-preventable diseases.
The second part of her question. Go ahead.
So the other thing is that there are vaccines that prevent diseases that result in much more deaths. So, for example, there were 80,000 people last year that died from the flu. That's more than car accidents. That's more than AIDS at the peak of the epidemic. And in fact, if you're a high-risk person, simply getting the flu shot decreases your risk of dying by something like 50%. So there are vaccines that actually prevent illness and death from much more common illness. Were much more common diseases.
And one of her comments was that before the vaccine, your risk was some minute percentage. No, before the vaccine, your risk was 100%. Everybody got measles. It was one of those childhood diseases that every child got. So it was 100%.
I think she was talking about deaths from it, but...
Yeah. But again, we're talking about something that is... We were not there. We have not seen it because of the success of vaccines. And so retrospectively, it may seem like a small deal, but... Not a small deal to those who lost people.
Anna asks, people claim that they're not getting their kids vaccinated because of vaccine injury. How common are vaccine injuries, and what are real vaccine injuries? I have a friend who claims that her child has 13 food and environmental allergies because of vaccines.
The problem is that many things occur in the population at low levels randomly. And there is often... People perceive an association because something bad happened right after they got the vaccine. If you vaccinate several million children, some of that will happen. The data I'm most familiar with is, for example, Guillain-Barré. Guillain-Barré is an ascending paralysis. People start getting weak in the legs. It goes up to their head. And some people end up with permanent damage. Some people die. Happens in roughly 1 out of 1 million flu vaccines. On the other hand, if you get the flu... It happens in 4 per 100,000. So there is a risk from the flu vaccine of getting Guillain-Barré. There's roughly a 50-fold greater risk if you get the flu. Part of the problem is that when you vaccinate large numbers of people, or you do anything to large numbers of people, the bad stuff that happens in the background will sometimes occur near the time of the vaccination. That's why they have close monitoring of any side effects or perceived side effects of the vaccines, because it's sometimes hard to distinguish this happened because of the vaccine versus we're vaccinating a lot of people and this just happened randomly at low risk at a low incidence in the population.
I just recently talked to someone who's told me that their brother had gotten the flu shot and gotten the flu right afterwards and blamed the flu shot for getting the flu. You've heard that I know you've heard that fairly often.
Yeah, so a couple of things. They've actually studied this. They've actually taken people, given them the flu shot, or given them an injection of saline, a placebo. The only thing that happens more commonly if you get the flu shot is you get a little bit of a sore arm. And I get my flu shot every year, probably every third year I get a sore arm. In addition, people say, oh my God, I got the flu shot and I got the flu anyway. First of all, the flu shots don't work 100% of the time, but you'll get less sick if you get the flu. Chances of dying if you're a high-risk person go down by 50%. And the flu doesn't protect against any of the other viruses that circulate during respiratory season, including the common cold. So many people say flu shot didn't work because I got the flu when they really got something else.
Yeah, the concerns over the MMR and the alleged link with autism came because the MMR is given at 1 year of age. And the developmental delays that are typical signals of an autistic child are diagnosed right around the same time. And so there was this temporal association between the two, meaning time association. You got the vaccine, and then a few months later, your child is not developing correctly. You take them to your physician, and they diagnosed them with autism. And so that was the beginning of the suspicion of the MMR vaccine, which now autism is being diagnosed at much earlier ages. And there were also comparisons between autistic and neurotypical people, and they had the same rates of vaccination. And then they did a comparison of autism rates between non-vaccinated and vaccinated, and they have the same rates of autism. So there's no association there.
Let's take one more phone call. Is it Enid? Am I pronouncing your name correctly from Hanover?
Yep.
Okay. Enid, what's your question or comment?
Well, I'm a nurse, and I'm in my 50s. I was vaccinated for measles as a young child. And when I was 23, I was working as an RN in Maryland, and I got a case of the measles. It's just like the doctors had said. I must have, another person at the hospital where I worked had it. It was not somebody I worked directly with. We must have stood next to one another in the elevator, the cafeteria, or something like that. I've never been so sick in my life, and I would never wish it on anybody else. I think that anybody who doesn't get their child vaccinated is extremely foolish. I work with moms and babies, and what I tell patients who tell me they're hesitant about vaccines is that if you're going to put your child in a car, even in the car seat, you're risking a lot more death and disability than you are by getting your child vaccinated. After being that ill, I just strongly, strongly believe in vaccines. And I think if we had a time machine and we could go back and see how people suffered with some of these diseases before there were vaccinations, our minds would be opened, and we would be so glad that we have them.
Enid, thank you very much for your call. Is that obviously it's not typical, but it sounds like it happens that someone who has been vaccinated still got measles.
Yeah. No vaccine is perfect. No vaccine protects you 100% of the time. And like we said at the beginning, 93% if you get the first shot, 97% effective if you get the two shots. So you still have that between 3% and 7% of people who may not develop immunity against measles. That's where the concept of community immunity, of having enough people surrounding you who are immune, to protect you.
We have only a minute left. I'm going to try to get to some of these questions. Vacation shedding. What is your opinion on this? Can people be vaccinated to make not? I don't understand the question, but you're going to on vacation in one of these countries. Do you need a booster shot? That's another question we're getting here.
I would have them look at the CDC website. They have travel advisories for all the countries around the world, and they have recommendations on vaccinations, not just for measles, but for other things like yellow fever, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Is there a parallel to smallpox? Isn't there a state law requiring a smallpox vaccine? Why not for MMR?
There's no longer a state requirement for a smallpox vaccine because we eliminated smallpox from the world. So it used to be it was one of the recommended vaccines. Because it was so rare and because it's really been eliminated, there's been no cases of naturally acquired smallpox since 1977. There are no requirements for smallpox vaccines anymore. Again, it becomes a philosophical question.
And measles can be eradicated just like smallpox was, and when that happens, we will no longer need MMR.
So eliminated, when it comes to smallpox, really did mean eliminated.
Eliminated from the world.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Dr. John Goldman, Dr. Renee Nahara, thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
With us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about the Central Pennsylvania Spelling Bee. Again, TMI coming up next week.